January 31st, 2021. I'm your reader, Natalie Chin, and we'll be moving on to the first articles of the day. Excuse me. Where's the Beef? Meat Lockers Booked as Pandemic Derails Food Chain by Kristen Guess. It's all hands on deck behind the retail counter at Orly's Meat Locker in Clarksville, where owner Troy Reynolds joins three staff members butchering a beef carcass on a recent Wednesday. Two other staff members are quickly packaging, weighing, and labeling the cuts. The meat will be sold in no time. Quote, "We've been fortunate to be busy since the pandemic. We are extremely busy," Reynolds said. Slaughter operations like Orly's are booming as many large meatpacking plants across the country were closed or drastically slowed down due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A soaring demand for beef and a crippled supply chain caused the traditional farm-to-fork cycle to derail. Farmers and meat lovers began to find alternatives, leaving meat lockers in northeast Iowa and across the Midwest overwhelmed and forced to turn away farmers. Reynolds' schedule is so full he can't take new beef processing appointments until 2022. Last spring, large meatpacking facilities became hotspots for COVID-19. The virus took advantage of crowded workspaces and employees afraid of losing their jobs. It quickly ravaged workforces, shutting down plants and significantly slowing down others. Two of the seven largest U.S. facilities, those with the capacity to process 5,000 beef cattle daily, were closed temporarily because of the pandemic, according to the Washington Post. Iowa Premium Plant in Tama, owned by National Beef Packing Company, suspended production for a week and had 177 out of more than 500 workers tested positive for coronavirus. An order given on April 28th by former President Donald Trump classified meat processors as critical infrastructure and forced workers back to the production line. By April, temporary plant closures and a hollowed-out workforce reduced beef production by more than a third, according to the Wall Street Journal. Production slowed, creating a bottleneck. Farmers still had a steady supply of animals ready for processing, but nowhere to go with them. Grocers were left with sparse, even bare meat cases, forcing consumers on the hunt for beef to turn elsewhere. Grocery stores like Hy-Vee and Fairway began to ration beef sales. On May 5th, Wendy's fast food chain had stopped serving beef hamburgers at about 20% of its 5,500 U.S. restaurants. Some Subway restaurants temporarily eliminated beef from their menu. Management at Single Speed Brewing Company in Waterloo reported their cost for beef also spiked. Ground beef prices increased by 184% from May 2019 to May 2020, and beef I-round prices shot up 264%. Upcharges for food with beef products are reported at other area restaurants. Quote, "We didn't have trouble getting it, but we also were making probably less than 40% of the amount of food we were making the year before," said General Manager Anna Hanisch. Customers' demand for beef sent many straight to the source, farmers. Local farmers began to see double and triple sales of whole, half, and quarter cows. Crystal Blaine, co-owner of JJB Cattle Co. in Independence, never thought she'd see a shortage of beef at the grocery store. This is, after all, Iowa. Quote, "It was a supply chain issue," she said. "There wasn't a shortage of animals. The supply chain that had been built up over the last few decades was disrupted," unquote. The spike in direct-to-consumer beef sales prompted the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation in August to launch a farm-to-table webinar series to assist farmers. Dan and Lynn Bolin, owners of the New Day Dairy in Clarksville, signed up for the webinar after they began selling retired dairy cows to be processed as ground beef. Quote, "We realized there was a need in our community," Lynn Bolin said. At first, the Bolins had no problem getting appointments at Orly's Meat Locker to process the cows. In April, Lynn booked an appointment for 3 weeks away. By May, they discovered Orly's was booked 3 months out. Today, the locker's 2021 calendar is full, and booking is a year out. Quote, "I have the cow, and I have the customer," Lynn Bolin said. "But there's an in-between piece that's missing. There's not a place that animal can be turned into something they can eat," unquote. The story is the same at the Elma Meat Locker. Owner Roger Merrick said the locker has been in the family since 1937, and he has never seen such high demand for local beef. Retail business doubled for several months last summer as customers were frantically buying beef and other meat in bulk. Sales spiked and have since leveled off, but are still about 50% higher than usual, he said. Merrick added a handful of part-time staff to keep up with demand, noting, too, that processing has become more difficult as animals grew overweight while farmers waited for processing appointments. Quote, "We were essential, and people needed us," Merrick said. The blends at JJB Cattle in Independence stopped waiting for meat lockers to catch up. Quote, "That part of our business is just not going to happen this year," Crystal Blinn said to farm-to-consumer beef sales. "The demand is there, but we can't get any spots," unquote. Because of the bottleneck, the Blinns found themselves with extra calves that will likely need to be sold to feed to a feedlot program. Those programs sell beef to grocery stores and restaurants. Quote, "Whether you buy beef from us directly or you buy beef from the grocery store, you are still supporting farmers," she said. Iowa Governor Reynolds signs one K-12 school priority and makes a pitch for another by Aaron Murphy. The ink was not yet dry on Governor Kim Reynolds' first K-12 education priority Friday when she began lobbying for her next proposal, one that may be short on support. Actually, I believe this exact same article was read in the Mason City Globe Gazette earlier today, so I'm going to move on to the next article, Rag-Bri Route Announced, Waterloo and Overnight Stop, by Sydney Chisholm. Thousands of bicyclists will bolster Waterloo's economy as Rag-Bri passes through the city in July on its annual 7-day journey across Iowa. The July 25th through 31st event, the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa, was canceled in 2020 due to COVID-19. This year's 426-mile route will include overnight stops from west to east in Lamars, Sac City, Fort Dodge, Iowa Falls, Waterloo, Anamosa, and DeWitt. The ride will end in Clinton. Riders will come stay in Waterloo on July 28th. The organization announced the route Saturday evening from Big Grove Brewery and Tap Room in Iowa City, streaming the event virtually for online viewers. Tavis Hall, director of Experience Waterloo, attended the Iowa City event. Hall said the event will drive people to restaurants, bars, nightlife, hotels, and retail stores, all businesses heavily impacted by the pandemic. He said he expects a couple of $1 million in tourism revenue from Rag-Bri. Quote, "Assuming we can do it safely and responsibly, it couldn't be a better time," Hall said. Waterloo joined other overnight stops in making a video showcasing its qualities. The video, played to viewers on Saturday, had a Prince theme with references to the song Purple Rain. Event hosts said Waterloo is the expected spot for the year's pie-eating contest. Cedar Valley employer VGM Group will sponsor the overnight stop in Waterloo, Hall said. The company planned to sponsor the event last year before the cancellation. Experience Waterloo will work with Rag-Bri organizers to ensure riders are safe during COVID-19, Hall said. He said he is communicating with the Black Hawk County Health Department to create standards for riders who visit. Waterloo is the biggest stop on the 2021 route, and Hall thinks riders will benefit from seeing the mix of the city's communities. He said Waterloo residents form a mosaic of big-hearted folks. Quote, "Our hope is that it's not just folks pedaling through on roads and crashing for the night over at Exchange Park, but it's people really taking the opportunity to engage with our community, and our community taking the opportunity to engage with these riders," Hall said. The city will be looking for hundreds of volunteers to help prepare campgrounds and downtown festival grounds working along the route, welcome people to Waterloo, and clean up afterwards, Hall said. Recruitment efforts are expected to start in March or April. Longtime Rag-Bri organizer T.J. Juskovich cut ties with the ride sponsor in October 2019, starting up his own competing bicycle journey called Iowa's Ride. The competing ride is scheduled for July 18th through 24th, the website shows. Rag-Bri doubled the money it gives to host cities after Juskovich's departure. Waterloo will get $15,000 to help cover the cost of overnight riders staying at Exchange Park campsites, Hall said. The last time Rag-Bri made an overnight stop in Waterloo was July 29, 2010, when it returned after a 25-year hiatus. The main activity area was at Lost Island Water Park, but shuttle buses ferried riders to downtown attractions. Hall said 2021 riders can expect a ton of progress since the last time folks may have rode through city limits. The ride also overnighted in Waterloo in 1985 and 1974. Riders last spent the night in Cedar Falls in 2015. That stay centered around the UNI Dome. The city also hosted overnights in 2007, 1998, and 1989. Waverly was an overnight destination in 2014, 1999, and 1980. People who want to participate in Rag-Bri can use the organization's online registration guide to learn how to sign up. Questions linger about historic trial. GOP senators say it's too late to convict, by Sarah D. Wire from the Los Angeles Times. formal delivery by the House of an article of impeachment against former President Donald Trump shifted focus to the Senate, which will hold a trial soon to determine whether to convict him for inciting the January 6th riot at the Capitol. Never before has an impeachment process moved so quickly, or has a trial taken place after a president left office. Because of that lack of precedent, there are a lot of questions. Let's take a look at what we know. Can the Senate convict a president who is no longer in office? This is a difficult question to answer, and even constitutional experts don't agree. Quote, it's not one of these clear-cut things, Rutgers University political science professor and impeachment expert Ross Baker said. Article 1 of the Constitution gives the House sole power to impeach a president, and the Senate sole power over whether to convict. As such, each chamber largely sets the rules or procedures it follows. So, to that end, the Senate can pretty much set its own rules, and once the House impeached Trump, it became harder for the Senate to do nothing. Once the impeachment happened, the Senate had to have a trial. The Constitution gives no choice, Baker said. But a growing number of Republicans now say that even though they agree that Trump's actions were wrong and impeachable, it's too late to hold a trial because he has left office. Republicans and some constitutional scholars argue that the basic purpose of impeachment and conviction is to provide Congress with a way to remove someone from office for committing gross offenses against the country, rather than waiting for the next election. Is there really no historical precedent? Not for a president. The closest example in history is the 1876 case of War Secretary William Belknap, who raced to the White House to submit his resignation moments before the House began voting to impeach him for corruption. Wary of letting someone use resignation as a way to escape penalty, the House passed 5 articles of impeachment, charging Belknap with criminally disregarding his duty as Secretary of War and basely prostituting his high office to his lust for private gain, unquote. The Senate, too, determined it retained jurisdiction to impeach former government officials and held a trial. The Senate fell short of the 2/3 vote threshold to convict required in the Constitution, and Belknap was acquitted. The first impeachment in history, that of Senator William Blount, was similar, but resulted in a different outcome. Blount, the first senator from Tennessee, was expelled from the Senate in 1797 after being accused of conspiring with the British to seize control of Louisiana and Florida from the Spanish, something that would have benefited him financially. The House impeached Blount after he was expelled. The Senate determined during his 1799 trial that it didn't have jurisdiction to convict him, and the case was dismissed. What's the point of convicting a president already out of office? It's too late to remove Trump from office, but the Constitution allows the Senate, if they convict, to also vote to bar the person from ever holding elected office again. The Senate has disqualified only 3 people from holding future office, all federal judges. Conviction today takes 67 senators, an extremely high bar considering the 50-50 party split in the Senate. But the Constitution is silent on how many senators must approve stripping the ability to hold office again, and in the past, the Senate has required only a simple majority. Following through with the trial is also a way to enforce that elected or civil officers cannot avoid punishment by resigning or because their actions took place at the end of their term, said University of Virginia law professor Saikrishna Prakash, who is among those constitutional scholars who say the Senate can convict Trump. Quote, an officer cannot terminate the process by just quitting and say, haha, you can't get me, Prakash said. Will it go to court? Perhaps. Trump might try to file a lawsuit, but whether the courts are willing to wade into a power the Constitution specifically delegates to Congress is another question. In its 1993 Nixon v. United States decision involving a Mississippi federal judge, the Supreme Court said the Senate has a right to determine its own impeachment procedures. Quote, my guess is the Supreme Court would not review this case. The impeachment power of Congress is very, very broad, said Julian Epstein, who was chief counsel for the House Judiciary Committee during President Bill Clinton's impeachment. Quote, it's sort of a non-reviewable power. It would be an extreme step for the court to step in, unquote. Will Chief Justice Roberts preside? Chief Justice John Roberts is not presiding at the trial as he did during Trump's first impeachment. The shift is said to be in keeping with protocol because Trump is no longer in office. Instead, Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, who serves in the largely ceremonial role of Senate President pro tempore, was sworn in. This process is more akin to a jury trial in which the senators will vote to convict or acquit. The presiding officer's role is mostly about being a traffic cop. He doesn't render a verdict, though he will get a vote in the end. Some Republicans are raising questions about the appearance and potential bias of having a Democrat preside over the trial and then get a vote. Since Trump isn't in office, who pays for his lawyers? Conservative interest groups could help with the bills, like they did when Trump was impeached in 2019. The Republican National Committee could help. Or Trump could set up a legal defense fund, similar to what Clinton did in 1999. Now for a look at the Defense Production Act, how the 1950 law is relevant today in fighting COVID-19. By Andrew Selsky. Like his predecessor, President Joe Biden is invoking a 1950 law to boost production of supplies needed to confront the coronavirus pandemic. The Defense Production Act was signed by President Harry S. Truman during the Korean War. It gives the president broad authority to mobilize the resources and production of private companies to meet the needs of the national defense. A look at the Defense Production Act. What it does. The Act gives the federal government broad authority to direct private companies to meet the needs of the national defense. Over the decades, the law's powers have been understood to encompass not only times of war, but also domestic emergency preparedness and recovery from terrorist attacks and natural disasters. The Act authorizes the president to require companies to prioritize government contracts and orders seen as necessary for the national defense, with the goal of ensuring that the private sector is producing enough goods needed to meet a war effort or other national emergency. It also authorizes the president to use loans, direct purchases, and other incentives to increase production of critical goods and essential materials. Other provisions authorize the federal government to establish voluntary agreements with private industry and to block foreign mergers and acquisitions seen as harmful to national security. How it was used before. When former President Donald Trump invoked the authority of the Defense Production Act in 2020, the primary focus was on masks for healthcare workers, ventilators, gloves, and eye protectors. The government acknowledged a significant gap between the number of masks it needed for healthcare workers and the number of masks it had actually stockpiled. Two decades ago, the administrations of both President Bill Clinton and George W. Bush invoked it to ensure that electricity and natural gas shippers continued supplying California utilities to cope with an energy crisis there, according to a 2009 Congressional Research Service report. It was used again during the Iraq War to prioritize the supply of certain military equipment to British forces serving there, the CRS report said. It was also used after Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico in 2017, when the Federal Emergency Management Agency sought to prioritize contracts for food, bottled water, manufactured housing units, and the restoration of electrical systems. What is the focus this time? White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said processes are ongoing to use the Cold War era provision to boost vaccine supplies, Biden's national strategy for combating the pandemic, released on Biden's first full day in office, puts the effort into context. Quote, "The national vaccination effort will be one of the greatest operational challenges America has ever faced," the document says. To ensure all Americans can be vaccinated quickly, the president has developed a plan for expanding vaccine manufacturing and purchasing COVID-19 vaccine doses for the U.S. population by fully leveraging contract authorities, including the Defense Production Act. Psaki told reporters, "The president absolutely remains committed to invoking the Defense Production Act in order to get the supply and the materials needed to get the vaccine out to Americans across the country." Acquisition of specialized syringes is also on the White House's mind. Psaki said these low dead volume syringes allow pharmacists and vaccinators to ensure more of the vaccine is used in a shot, quote, "making more doses available, of course." More ordinary syringes can leave fluid in the needle and in the space between the plunger and the syringe hub. More on the virus. For most people, the new coronavirus causes only mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever and cough. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia. The vast majority of people recover from the new virus. According to the World Health Organization, people with mild illness recover in about 2 weeks, while those with more severe illness may take 3 to 6 weeks to recover. And that does it for my reading. We're going to move on to a new reader of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Jenner Lathrop. Take it away, Jenner.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Natalie. I'll take it from here. Our next article is New COVID-19 Cases Plunge as Behavior Changes by Christina Jewett out of the Kaiser Health News. Dozen states are reporting drops of 25% or more in new COVID-19 cases, and more than 1,200 counties have seen the same, new federal data shows. Experts say the plunge may relate to growing fear of the virus after it reached record level highs, as well as soaring hopes of getting vaccinated soon. Nationally, new cases have dropped 21% from the prior week, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, reflecting slightly more than 3,000 counties. Corresponding declines in hospitalization and death may take weeks to arrive, and the battle against the deadly virus rages on at record levels in many places. Health officials, data modeling experts, and epidemiologists agreed it's too early to see a bump from the vaccine rollout that started with healthcare workers in late December and has, in many states, moved on to include older Americans. Instead, they said, the factors involved are more likely behavior-driven, with people settling back home after the holidays or reacting to news of hospital beds running out in places like Los Angeles. Others are finding the resolve to wear masks and physically distance with the prospect of a vaccine becoming more immediate. A single reason is hard to pinpoint, said Adrian Casalotti, Chief of Government and Public Affairs for the National Association of County and City Health Officials. She said it may be due in part to people hoping to avoid the new, more contagious variants of the virus, which some experts say appear to be deadlier as well. She also had so many people get sick in the last surge that more people may be taking precautions. There's a better chance you know someone who had it, Casalotti said. Eva Lee, a mathematician and engineering professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology, works on models predicting COVID-19 patterns. She said in an email that the decline reflects the natural course of the virus as it infects a social web of people, exhausts that cluster, dies down, and then emerges in new groups. She also said that the national trend, with even steeper drops in California, also reflects restrictions in that state, which included closing indoor dining and a 10 p.m. curfew in hard-hit regions. She said these measures take a few weeks to show up in new case data. It's a very unstable equilibrium at the moment, Lee wrote in the email. So any premature celebration would lead to another spike, as we have seen it time and again in the United States. Four California counties were among the five large U.S. counties seeing the steepest case drops, including Los Angeles County, where the new cases declined nearly 40% in the week ending January 25th compared with the week before. Dr. Karen Michaels, chair of epidemiology at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, said the lower numbers in Los Angeles after the virus infected 1 in 8 county residents likely mirror what's happened after New York City's surge. People got very scared and changed their behavior. People are beginning to understand we really need to get our act together in Los Angeles, so that helps, she said. The big fear now is it really going in this direction? Is it plateauing? Or where is it going to go? We need to go further down because it's really high. Michaels said herd immunity would not explain the decline since we are nowhere near the level of 70% of the population having had the disease or been vaccinated. She said the declines may also reflect a drop in testing, as Dodger Stadium has been converted from a mass testing site to a mass vaccination center. Officials with the California Department of Public Health acknowledge that testing has fallen off, but overall rates of positive COVID-19 tests are falling, suggesting the change is real. New cases also fell significantly in Wyoming, Oregon, South Dakota, and Utah, with each state recording at least 30% fewer new cases. Each of those states reported having vaccinated 8% or more of their adult population by Tuesday, putting them among the top 20 states in terms of vaccination rate. Alaska leads the states currently at nearly 15%. It's also logged a new case drop of 24% in recent days. Yet experts aren't willing to say that the vaccines are driving cases down. Most people in public health don't think we'll see the benefit of the vaccine until a few months from now, said Dr. Marcus Plescia, Chief Medical Officer of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. The number of deaths continues to remain high, weeks after high case rates, as the virus variably attacks the heart, kidneys, lungs, and nervous system. Many patients remain unconscious and on ventilator for weeks as doctors search for signs of improvement. The death rate fell by only 5% in the data posted Wednesday, reflecting 21,790 patients who died of the virus from January 19th through the 25th. Anxiety about new strains of the virus from the UK, Brazil, and South Africa remains high in Portland's Multnomah County, Oregon, which saw a drastic 43% new case decline in recent days. The concern is that everything could change, said Kate Yeiser, spokesperson for the Multnomah Health County Department. Okay, moving right along with our national news. The next article, Climate Fight Means Changes to America, by Seth Borenstein out of the Associated Press. Climate isn't the only thing changing. What comes next in the nation's struggle to combat global warming will probably transform how Americans drive, where they get their power, and other bits of day-to-day life, both quietly and obviously, experts say. So far, the greening of America has been subtle, driven by market forces, technology, and voluntary actions. The Biden administration is about to change that. In a flurry of executive actions in his first 8 days in office, the president is trying to steer the U.S. economy from one fueled by fossils to one that no longer puts additional heat-trapping gases into the air by 2050. The United States is rejoining the International Paris Climate Accord and is also joining many other nations in setting an ambitious goal that once seemed unattainable: net zero carbon emissions by mid-century. That means lots of changes designed to fight increasingly costly climate disasters such as wildfires, floods, droughts, storms, and heat waves. Think of the journey to a carbonless economy as a road trip from Washington, D.C. to California that started about 15 years ago. We've made it through Ohio and up to the Indiana border, but the road has been pretty smooth so far. It gets rougher ahead, said the climate scientist Zeke Hausfather, climate and energy director at the Breakthrough Institute. The Biden administration is both stepping on the gas and working to upgrade our vehicle, Hausfather said. The end results of some of Biden's new efforts may still not be noticeable, such as your power eventually coming from ever cheaper wind and solar energy instead of coal and natural gas that now provides 59% of American power. But when it comes to going from here to there, then you'll notice. General Motors announced Thursday that as of 2035, it hopes to go all electric for its light-duty vehicles, no longer selling gas cars. Experts expect most new cars sold in 2030 to be electric. The Biden administration promised 550,000 charging stations to help with the transition to electric cars. You will no longer be going to a gas station, but you will need to charge your vehicle whether at home or on the road, said Kate Larson, director of international climate policy research at the Rhodium Group. It may be a whole new way of thinking about transportation for the average person. But it will still be your car, which is why most of the big climate action over the next 10 years won't be too noticeable, said the Princeton University ecologist Stephen Pakula. The single biggest difference is that because wind and solar is distributed, you will see a lot more of it on the landscape, said Pakula, who leads a Decarbonizing America study by the National Academy of Sciences that comes out next week. Other recent detailed scientific studies show that because of dropping wind, solar, and battery prices, Biden's net zero carbon goal can be accomplished far cheaper than feared in the past, with health benefits many, many times outweighing the cost, said Pakula, who was part of one study at Princeton. Those studies agree on what needs to be done for decarbonization, and what Biden has come out with is doing the things that everyone now is concluding that we should do, Pakula said. These are the types of shifts that don't cost much, about a dollar per day per person, and won't require people to abandon their current cars and furnaces, but replace them with cleaner electric vehicles and heat pumps when it comes time for a new one, said Margaret Torn, a senior scientist at the Department of Energy, who co-authored a peer-reviewed study Wednesday. One Biden interim goal, a carbon pollution-free power sector by 2035, may not be doable that quickly, but it can be done by 2050, said study co-author Jim Williams of the University of San Francisco. Biden's executive orders featured plans for an all-electric federal fleet of vehicles, conserving 30% of the country's land and waters, doubling the nation's offshore wind energy, and funding to help communities become more resilient to climate disasters. Republicans and fossil fuel interests objected, calling the actions job killers. The next big thing for the administration is to come up with a Paris Climate Accord goal, called Nationally Determined Contribution, for how much the United States hopes to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It has to be ambitious for the president to reach his ultimate goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but it also has to be doable. His administration promises to reveal the goal, required by the climate agreement but non-binding, before its Earth Day climate summit on April 22nd. That new number is actually the centrally important activity of the year, said University of Maryland environment professor Nate Holtman, who worked on the Obama administration's Paris goal. Getting to net zero carbon emissions mid-century means about a 43% cut from 2005 levels, the baseline the U.S. government uses, by 2030. The U.S. can realistically reach a 40% cut by 2030, which is about one-third of the reduction from what 2020 U.S. carbon emissions would have been without a pandemic, said Williams, the San Francisco professor. All this work on power and vehicles, that's easy compared with decarbonizing agriculture with high methane emissions from livestock and high-heat industrial processes such as steelmaking, Breakthrough's Hausfather said. There's no silver bullet for agriculture, Hausfather said. There's no solar panels for cows, so to speak, apart from meat alternatives. But even there, you have challenges around consumer acceptance. All right, that does it for national news today. Next up, we'll be moving on to the obituaries. First up today, we have Ms. Rosemary Rosie M. Shares, 85, of Jessup, died Thursday, January 28th at Unity Point Hospice. She was born on September 4th, 1935 in Blackhawk County, the daughter of Leonard and Margaret Schneider Federspiel. She married Richard Shares on November 8th, 1955 at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Raymond. Rosie was a homemaker and also cleaned houses in the area. She is preceded in death by her parents, her siblings, and her grandson and stepmother. Memorials may be dedicated to Immaculate Conception Church or Gilbertville Fire Department. Dr. Daniel Joseph Power, out of Cedar Falls, 70, passed away unexpectedly at home on Tuesday, January 26th, from natural causes. He was born on February 9, 1950 in Waterloo, the son of Laverne and Maxine Power. Dan graduated from West High School with the class of 1968, then earned his Bachelor of Science in 1974 and his Master of Arts in 1977 from the University of Iowa, and his MBA in 1981 and his PhD in 1982 from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His first faculty position was with the University of Maryland, College Park, where he met the graduate assistant to a colleague with the neighboring office, Carol Pocodner. Dan and Carol were married January 12, 1985, at the Beth Torah Congregation of Hyattsville, Maryland. They moved their family to Cedar Falls in August of 1989, when Dan became professor and management department head in the College of Business at the University of Northern Iowa. In 1996, he served as acting dean for the College of Business and remained, to date, an active member of the faculty. Dan's expertise was renowned, and he served as a lecturer or visiting scholar abroad at universities in Italy, Spain, India, Ireland, Brazil, Colombia, Russia, China, and Turkey. He was a widely published author of numerous journals and seven books. Dan's memorial service was held on Friday, January 29th at Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home of Cedar Falls. Memorials may be directed to the UNI Foundation for a scholarship in the College of Business to be established in Dan's name. Dan was a born leader and innovative thinker. In high school, he attended Boise State, was an honor scholar, and already a gifted speaker. In college, Dan held a leadership role in the U of I Democrats and was Johnson County Democratic Chairman. Dan served as chair of the University of Northern Iowa faculty, chair of the UNI Faculty Senate, and president of UNI United Faculty AAUP, the faculty collective bargaining group. The roles he cherished most of all, however, were husband to his loving wife and father to his accomplished sons. Next up, Gary E. Miller, 80, of Shell Rock, Iowa, passed away early Wednesday morning at Unity Point Health Allen Memorial Hospital in Waterloo, Iowa. Gary was born on October 11, 1940, in Butler County, Iowa, the son of Faith Knight and William Ernest Miller. Gary graduated from Waverly High School in 1958. On October 16, 1960, Gary was united in marriage to Betty Marie Jacobs at Faith Lutheran Church in Shell Rock. Gary was a self-employed businessman with an entrepreneurial spirit. Among others, he started and owned Gemco and owned and operated Waverly Box and Pallet. He retired in 1994. On October 20th, 2012, Betty passed away after 52 years of marriage. Gary was a member of Faith Lutheran Church in Shell Rock. He enjoyed bowling, golfing, fishing, woodworking, and men's slow-pitch softball. He passionately served others as a 19-year-old member of the Shell Rock Fire Department, served as an EMT on the Shell Rock Ambulance Service, volunteered countless hours in many capacities supporting Go Hawk Athletics. More recently, Gary supported the New Hampton Chickasaws and was also a Chickasaw Athletic Booster Club member. Gary and Betty enjoyed 20-plus years of trailer life on Lake Pepin in Lake City, Minnesota. Above all, Gary's greatest enjoyment was his grandchildren and following and supporting them in all of their activities. Anyone that knew Gary knew his grandchildren were his greatest pride and joy. Gary's memory is honored by two sons, a daughter, seven grandchildren, two brothers, and several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his wife Betty, his parents, and his brother Mick. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. on Monday, February 1st at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly, and 1 hour prior to the service at the church on Tuesday. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, February 2nd at Faith Lutheran Church in Shell Rock with Pastor Kevin Frey officiating. Burial will follow at Riverside Cemetery, Shell Rock. Masks and social distancing are required for all services. Memorials may be directed to Gary's family. Next up, Don Edward Gottschalk. Don Edward Gottschalk, 77, of Cedar Falls, Iowa, passed away peacefully on Thursday, January 21st, surrounded by a loving family after fighting a 20-year-long and courageous battle with cancer. He was born at the family farm in Elkader, Iowa, September 26, 1943, son of Elmer and Leona Gottschalk. He graduated in 1959 from Elkader Central High School, then attended the University of Iowa, where he received his Juris Doctor Law degree in 1967. Don began his career as a law clerk to Theodore Garfield, Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. The judge introduced him to Sarah Lee Malone of Ames, Iowa. The Vietnam War and Don's enlistment in the Iowa National Guard speeded up their courtship. They were married in Ames on April 28, 1968. They moved to Cedar Falls in 1969, where he began practicing law, eventually opening and running his private practice until he retired in the fall of 2020. Don was preceded in death by his parents, his brother and sister-in-law, and his brother-in-law, Jack Grimes, survived by his beloved older sister, Elaine Grimes. Don will be lovingly remembered by his wife of 53 years and his children, granddaughters, his son, and her children, and step-grandsons. He will be forever dearly remembered by his in-laws and numerous cousins, nephews, nieces, extended family, and dear friends. He is deeply loved and missed. The family will be holding a private memorial service, but you are invited to view virtually at the website www.facebook.com/CedarHeightsPRES. Prez. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in Don's name to the Cedar Falls Rotary Club, to the Cedar Valley Hospice, or to the charity of your choice. Michael Allen Sheehan, 69, of Cedar Falls, died at home on Wednesday, January 27th. He was born on January 18, 1952, in Clarion, Iowa, the son of Paul and Ruth Sheehan. Michael married Cynthia Schmidt on September 4, 1982, in Klinger, Iowa. He was a graduate of Clarion High School, worked at several jobs, and spent the last 18 years in general maintenance at the Cedar Falls Walmart, retiring just a few years ago. Michael loved spending time with family and friends. He is survived by his wife, Cindy Sheehan, of Cedar Falls, his daughter and their son, a brother, three sisters, and two brothers-in-law. Michael was preceded in death by his parents, two brothers, a sister, a niece, a nephew, and his father and mother-in-law. Services will be 2 o'clock p.m. on Monday, February 1st, at St. John Lutheran Church in Cedar Falls. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. on Sunday, January 31st, at Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home in Cedar Falls, and 1 hour before the service at the church. Those attending the service or visitation must bring and wear a mask and practice social distancing. Memorials may be directed to the church. Dennis James Utley was born on October 14, 1955, to William and Bernice Utley in Waterloo, Iowa. Dennis lived in Sanford, Florida, and died January 21st of a sudden illness. Dennis graduated from Waterloo's West High School in 1974 and joined the U.S. Navy to spend many years as a fighting CB. Dennis also discovered a passion for scuba diving and went diving in some of the most beautiful waters on Earth. There is so much more to say about Dennis Utley that words cannot convey. His charismatic smile, infectious laugh, and loving nature are truly things that anyone who has ever met him will miss. Dennis is preceded in death by his parents, his older sister, his nephew, and his niece. Survivors are his sister and brother. Dennis is also remembered by his nieces and nephews. And he was a great uncle to 5 great nieces and 2 great nephews. In lieu of flowers or cards, donations may be made in Dennis's name to the Disabled American Veterans Chapter in Sanford, Florida. In the memo line, please include the words Dennis Utley Donation. Next up we have Bradley Reese Annaweer. Bradley Reese Annaweer, 63, of Waterloo, went home to be with his Heavenly Father on Friday, January 22nd at Mercy One Hospital in Des Moines, Iowa. He was born on May 12, 1957. After graduating from Hudson High School, Brad enlisted in the Navy stationed in San Diego. He married Teresa Anderson in October of 1979. He is survived by his wife Teresa, 3 sons, and 1 daughter, and he was preceded in death by his parents. No services will be held at this time. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Next up, we have David C. Bruns. On Monday, January 25th, longtime Cedar Falls resident David C. Bruns, loving husband, father of 2 sons, and grandfather of 8 children, entered into eternal life at the age of 66. Dave was born on March 23, 1954, in Belmont, Iowa, to Curtis and Bonnie Bruns. On May 5, 1972, he married Barbara Joanne Schmidt. They raised 2 sons, Nicholas and Daniel. He attended Hawkeye Technical College until 1973, studying mechanical design and machining. He was hired as a wage employee at John Deere in 1974 and retired as a machinist in 2012. Over the past year, he worked part-time at Ace Hardware in Cedar Falls. He was an active member of Jordan Crossing Church, helping prepare and serve community meals on Friday nights, which helped support his gift of gab. Not only did Dave love spending time with his family, he had a passion for the outdoors and was an avid fisherman and hunter. He also enjoyed playing pool, card games, swimming, giving people a hard time, traveling, giving any dog around him treats, and trying to sing his favorite classic rock songs. When he wasn't busy working around his yard, helping neighbors, or anyone who needed a helping hand, he was attending his grandchildren's events such as swim meets, trap shooting meets, volleyball, softball, baseball, basketball games, or concerts with a big smile. If you drove with Dave, you better have held on tight. He would spend more time looking at deer and pheasants in the field or sharing stories of how he caught this big fish while giving you hand motions with his right hand. He didn't pay much attention to the road, but he got to where he was going. It was rare to go anywhere with him and not run into someone he knew, which turned into catch-up conversations. Not only did he give a lot, he never took anything from you besides some work. He lived by his values and always tried to do the right thing and be the best embodiment of a husband, father, grandfather, brother, uncle, cousin, neighbor, or friend. His caring heart, loud laugh, one-word texts, building numerous birdhouses, ability to fix about anything with a couple of well-placed screws, and his zest for life will be greatly missed. Dave was preceded in death by his father Curtis, his mother Bonnie, and 3 brothers. He is survived by his wife, his brother, his sister, several extended family members, his 2 sons, and 8 grandchildren. A celebration of Dave's life will be held later this year. If desired, friends can direct contributions to the family in support of a memorial fund, which will be established at a later date. Next up, Ronald Versluis. Ronald Versluis, 79, of Cedar Falls, died on Sunday, January 17th, at the Western Home Deary Suites from Parkinson's disease with complications from COVID-19. He was born on July 9th, 1941, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Emil and Madeleine Versluis. Ron married Nancy Huntley on May 16th, 1981, at the Little Brown Church in Nashua, Iowa. Ron worked at John Deere in Waterloo for 30 years, his last position on the J-hook line at the engine works. He also worked for several local farmers. Ron is now pursuing his favorite hobby of fishing with his three brothers, Bob, Jim, and Tom. He is survived by his wife, his son, and his estranged daughters, his stepchildren, five grandchildren, and five step-grandchildren, and three sisters. Ron was preceded in death by his parents and three sisters. Services will be private. Memorials may be directed to Unity Point Hospice or Cedar Valley Hospice. Next up, we have Mr. Keith E. Carter. Keith E. Carter, 87, of Grundy Center, Iowa, passed away Saturday, January 16th, at Creekside in Grundy Center, Iowa. There will be no public services held at this time. Memorial contributions may be directed in Keith's name to Cedar Valley Hospice Care. Next, Della Marie Uddy. Della Marie Uddy, formerly of Waterloo, died on the morning of Saturday, January 16th, in Coral Reef Nursing and Rehab Center in Miami, Florida, of natural causes. She was born on January 24th, 1925, in Raymond, the daughter of Richard and Mabel Brownstocks. She married Kenneth Uddy on November 4th, 1947, and he preceded her in death on October 1st, 1984. Della was a loving mother, wife, sister, and grandmother. She had a very strong faith and read her Bible daily. She loved crocheting for her family, as well as making prayer blankets to be given to the nursing home. Della is survived by her two sons and one daughter, two sisters, seven grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren. Due to the COVID pandemic, a memorial service will be held at a later date with interment in the Garden of Memories Cemetery in Waterloo. And in lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. Next, we have Mr. James A. Brody, 92, of Waterloo, died on Friday, January 29th, at Lakeview Landing of Friendship Village. James was born on October 27, 1928, in Waterloo, the son of Condon and Pearl Rose Brody. He graduated from Waterloo East High School and Gates Business College. James served in the U.S. Army during World War II in Japan. He married Norma Hansen on October 31, 1950, at the Little Brown Church in the Vale in Nashua. She died on September 19, 2019. James started as a milkman for Carnation Dairy. He was the treasurer for a credit union before becoming deputy to the commissioner of the State Credit Union Division. He was a member of Central Christian Church and Ankeny Christian Church during his years in Des Moines. He is survived by four children, 10 grandchildren, 30 great-grandchildren, and his sister, Connie. James is preceded in death by his parents, his wife, and his two brothers. Funeral services will be held at 2 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, February 2nd, at the Central Christian Church in Waterloo, and the burial will be performed afterwards in the Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. Our next obituary is of Gerald Shields, known as Jerry to his friends. Age 82, of Waverly, Iowa, passed away at the Unity Point Allen Hospital in Waterloo on Thursday, January 28th, surrounded by his loving family. The family wishes not to have any services at this time. Jerry was born on September 17th, 1938, in Owen, Iowa. He was the son of the late John and Magdalene Shields. On September 11, 1982, Jerry married the love of his life, Kathy D. Stainbrook, in Nashua, Iowa, at the Little Brown Church. Jerry worked as a factory worker at John Deere in Waterloo for over 35 years until his retirement. Jerry loved to garden his grandkids, and he was always willing to lend a hand and help out wherever he could. He was very generous with his time and was a wonderful husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. Jerry and Kathy traveled everywhere together through the U.S., including Kansas, Illinois, Texas, Oklahoma, and especially Florida. Those left to cherish Jerry's memory are his wife, his children, 24 grandchildren, 22 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. Memorial contributions may be made in his name to the Unity Point Health Allen Hospital Hospice, And the family would like to thank the entire staff and doctors at the Unity du Point Ellen Hospital for all the care and support that they showed to Jerry. Our next obituary is of Lee R. Mickey, 79, who passed away peacefully from COVID-19 on Sunday, January 24th at Amber Glen Alzheimer's Special Care Center. Lee Mickey was born on February 19, 1941, in Cedar Falls, Iowa, to Albert and Una Mickey. He was a 1959 graduate of Cedar Falls High School and a graduate of the State College of Iowa, now UNI, with a bachelor's in mathematics and a master's in counseling. He married Linda Imhoff on June 13, 1964. He worked as a school counselor, coach, teacher, assistant principal, and principal for the Cedar Falls Community School District before retiring in 2000 to run a bed and breakfast with his wife in Vermont. He enjoyed renovating houses and chatting with guests at his bed and breakfast. Lee lived life to the fullest through simple pleasures, fishing in northern Minnesota, encouraging young students to their dreams and endeavors, conversing with friends and family and complete strangers, gardening, photography, and traveling across the United States. He was a sports enthusiast and a diehard Iowa Hawkeye fan. No ticket scalper could resist his plea to afford him the opportunity to take his grandson to his first Hawkeye football game, practically giving him the tickets. He was known for his sweet tooth and always had jelly beans or juju fruit candies to share with his grandchildren. Lee is survived by his wife, his daughter, and his son and daughter-in-law. He is also survived by 4 grandchildren. The family attended a private mass in his honor and will host a celebration of life service in the spring, both in Savoy and in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Our next obituary is of Betty Marie Hufnagel. Betty Marie Hufnagel, 86, of Cedar Falls, died on Wednesday, January 27th, at Pinnacle Specialty Care. She was born on January 28th, 1934, in Cedar Falls, the daughter of Elsie and Mabel Wilson. She graduated from Waterloo East High School in 1951 and Gates Business College in 1952. On August 30th of 1963, Betty married Raymond R. Hufnagel in Waterloo. He died on June 12, 1988. Betty was a medical secretary at the Mayo Clinic from 1957 to 1960, secretary for the doctors Morrison and Bailey until 1965, and then as a secretary at Cutler Hardware until she retired in 1972. After retirement, Betty worked part-time at the YWCA until 2004. She was a member of the Church of the Nazarene in Cedar Falls, where she taught adult Sunday school and was the church treasurer. She also volunteered with the Hawkeye Tech Adult Literacy Program. Betty is survived by 2 nephews, several cousins, and her good friend Michelle Danielson of Cedar Falls. She is preceded in death by her parents, husband, and 2 sisters-in-law. Private services will be held with burial in the Garden of Memory Cemetery in Waterloo. Lawana Creighton. Lawana Creighton, 73, of Cedar Falls, died Sunday, January 24th, at New Aldea Lifescapes. She was born on March 1, 1947, in Waterloo, the daughters of Louis J. Sr. and Mary A. Griggs Creighton. Lawana graduated from Waterloo East High School in 1966. She was then the head cook at Suki's. She also worked as a cook at a senior center, Ramada Inn, Holiday Inn, the Waterloo Airport Restaurant, and Saks on 7th for many years. She gave her life to Christ at an early age and attended Antioch Missionary School in Waterloo. She also loved dogs. She is survived by her son, 2 daughters, 8 siblings, a special cousin, and her good friend, Larry Brown of Evansdale. She's preceded in death by her parents, her partner, and her brother. Services will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. on February 5th at Locke Funeral Home, and the visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. on the same day. Next up, Robert A. Roof, or Bob, returned to the Lord on Sunday, January 24th, after a short illness. He was 95. He was preceded in death by the love of his life and wife of 67 years, Shirley, in 2015, and their firstborn infant daughter, Barbara Ann, as well as his parents and 3 siblings. He is survived by his 4 sons, as well as his younger sister. He and Shirley were also blessed with 10 grandchildren and multiple great-grandchildren. Bob was born and raised in Buffalo, New York. He joined the Navy during World War II as a signalman on a landing craft and returned to Buffalo, where he and Shirley reunited and were married. He worked in electronics repair temporarily, but subsequently felt that he was called to the ministry. He attended college at Westminster College in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, and then seminary at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. The family moved to Des Moines in 1957, where he was an associate pastor at Westminster Presbyterian Church. In 1963, the family again moved, this time to Cedar Falls. He became pastor of Cedar Heights Presbyterian Church and was there for many years until retirement. During his tenure at Cedar Heights, he attended UNI and got his master's in counseling and used that in his ministry. He and Shirley were a steady positive force in the community throughout their lives in Cedar Falls. They were heavily invested in service with the American Cancer Society for years and developed many friendships and were joyful with their experiences related to that. Bob also enjoyed golf and was a voracious reader. Most of all, he was a family man who led by his quiet example. Proverbs 3 seems to be a favorite scripture. The Roof household was always open for friends, family, food, and a good cup of coffee. He touched so many in his life and will be greatly missed. A celebration of his life and burial will be planned at a future date. And my apologies to everyone. I'm afraid I wasn't able to get through all of the obituaries today, and I'm afraid because this is our time today. So thank you so much for listening today. This has been the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. My name is Jenner Lathrop. Thank you so much for listening along. You can always access a recording of today's reading anytime on our website at iowaradioreading.org. That's, once again, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Thanks.